Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paul Hawksby.
And Andy Jacobs.
And welcome once again to the H&J Daily here on Talk Sport. It was a really sad day, wasn't it, in the world of football? The news this morning that Gordon Banks had died.
Yes, absolutely. So we started with a reflection on meeting Gordon ourselves.
Yeah.
And of course, what a great player he was. And
absolutely.
He'd have contributions throughout the show from people who knew him. And
including George Cohen and other people who joined us today. Also, we launched the H&J Book Club, a regular feature with Luke Moore. You'll know from the Football Ramble and, of course, the season ticket here on TalkSport every Friday. And the first book we looked at was The Damned United. So you'll hear that. Phil Hewitt popped in to see us. He is the author of a bestseller called Keep On Running. He's also written Outrunning the Demons, told a traumatic story that he went through.
Strong story, that was.
And how running was his saviour and how it has been the saviour for other people as well. So I hope you find that interesting.
And we got into a bit of a pickle about a posh waste of ink to the Times.
Yeah, it took a different turn, as you'll discover. Here it all is.
Yeah, good afternoon, Paul. It is very, very sad news, wasn't it? We have to start with that, I think. And we were lucky enough to meet Gordon on a few occasions. We interviewed him, and then
First time was when we went along to Aintree for the Friday before the Grand National, and Gordon and Roger Hunt were there. They both worked for the Paul's panel.
They were like the Paul's panel, yeah.
They would meet every week, and in case games were snowed off or called
because
off,
because it was more, you know, it happened more often than in the old days before the pitches improved.
It did, and they it was lovely to see him, wasn't it, for the first time and have a chat with him there. And then subsequently we started doing this job and were fortunate enough to interview him a few times. As recently as we said, about 18, 19 months ago, he came in with
and he was in Russia, Jeff, of course, for the draw. And we were there as well. Moscow.
Yeah. And as people have been saying today, he was a truly lovely fellow. There was no side to him at all. There was no, I'm the great Gordon Banks, I won the World Cup. Whenever we talked about modern keepers, it was never, oh, not as good as in my day. He was always very kind of, there was goalkeepers he liked. He was honest. That's what I used to find. If it was a keeper he thought was coming up short for England, he would say so. He'd have an honest appraisal. But I always got the sense, and from what other goalkeepers have said today, like Ben Foster and Paul Robinson and stuff, he was respected. And when they got a chance to have a chat with him, they hung on his every word. So
a very nice tribute from our old friend Bob Wilson this morning with Max. And we'll play a bit of that later, because he describes that save in a kind of technical way, which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Now, there is a bit of a thing, of course, you find these days where, you know, other things happen in life and then a little bit of revisionism goes on. And then you look back at an old piece of footage and you say, yeah, but it was this, it was that. It was in 1970. Players couldn't head the ball as hard then.
That's rubbish.
I don't think any of us are having it with a bank save. I mean, every time I watch it kind of defies physics.
No, it's an absolutely brilliant save. No question about it. And I think Gordon would have been disappointed at the goalkeeping last night, actually, in that game. Both goalies had a bit of a mare with the goals.
It's strange with Dubravka, because he had the mistake against Spurs, but he's had a great season. He pulled off very similar saves, two very similar saves for a crowd of bodies.
Mm.
And you thought he's got his mojo back, because he pulled off two good stops last night in the game. You thought, he did well to hold on to those. There was a lot of Wolves players waiting to get the rebound.
I felt for Newcastle last night, really. They honestly deserved to win. They did. Wolves were lucky. I see Nuno kind of reinventing it in that manager's way.
They created a lot of chances, though, Wolves, didn't they?
Not really, did they? I mean, they had some half chances. Doherty was a good chance, but it was a great clearance from Longstaff, who really impressed, actually. But he just said, in the last minute, we started putting balls into the box. We got the goal we deserved. That put some justice in the game. I was thinking, oh, you'd be hard pushed to say Newcastle didn't deserve to win that match. But
did you think, our old mate Mark Housie didn't think it was a foul? What did you think?
Which one? Oh, no.
The goal.
It's difficult because they analyse it brilliantly on Sky. I mean, when you watch it in real time, it's not a foul. When you watch it and you stop it, then he's got his arms right over him and it does look like a foul. So
yeah.
It shows you how hard VAR's going to be for things like that. But I think he should have just punched it, as they said. No question about it. We always say, why is he trying to catch it?
Yeah. Normally it's the other way around.
Yeah, why is he trying to punch it, Rob?
Yeah, of course. You're always thinking, why do they do that?
Never mind. In other news, Desert Island Discs has been voted the best ever radio show, followed by The Archers. We were third, apparently. It's not bad, is it?
That's good they didn't mention third, though, did they?
No.
That's this.
It's John Sherwood. Who cares who's third?
Yeah, that's right.
It's one of those. No, we weren't third.
No, I think the listeners listeners know that we weren't third.
That's right. Safe to say.
Yeah.
That's true. And a bloke who won the Sun's Recreate a Famous Portrait competition came up with the perfect way of doing this. This is always the best way to win a competition in a tabloid newspaper. It says, judges voted Alexander Slack's selfie, rather, with a collar made from the Sun.
Nice, can I have a look?
No, well, you can't. I haven't got the picture.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
It's basically a ruff. So he's made a rough collar.
Yeah,
it's a sort of Rembrandt, a famous thing with a ruff, and he's made it out of pages of the Sun.
Oh, I know. It's a nice touch, yeah.
It's always good. It's actually going to be on show in the Rembrandt Museum, isn't it?
Have you heard anything back yet from the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition?
No.
Have you not even had an acknowledgement for your...
I've had an acknowledgement. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of a laugh on it, a laughing emoji.
Who's among the judges? Do you know who the judges are?
No idea. I mean, they've got to whittle it down. They get something like about 20,000 entries, right. And then they whittle it down to about 4,000. Then they have a final selection.
Great if you get in, won't it?
I won't get in. Don't be
ridiculous. Why can't you've got as good a chance as anybody else?
Any chance at all?
Andy's doodles that he does. In case you've missed this, folks, Andy sits here and rather than listening to me or the guests, doodles during the show.
That's very harsh.
It's not true, but there's been moments anyway. But he doodles, and they're quite good. They're quite quirky, and one or two of the listeners have ended up sort of getting free ones, haven't they?
Oh, yeah.
You sent them on.
No, that's true.
But he sent them to the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy. Look, it's a punt. And how much was it per entry? 40 quid?
35 quid.
35 quid an entry.
It's cost me 70 quid. Just as an experiment, really, to see whether... Because, you know, art, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Art, you know, you can look at something and think, what a load of old rubbish, but somebody else will think it's brilliant.
That's
it's
true,
genius.
Andy. That is the very crux of it. So, we will be... we'll keep you in touch with that, of course.
Leonardo da Vinci's doodles are to be
Has he put one in?
No, they're to be made into stamps.
Are they?
To be fair, they're better than mine.
It'd be great, though, wouldn't it? I'm not so sure, actually. One or two of yours, they stand up with his early work.
You reckon?
Yeah, when he was about three.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast from TalkSport.
Hawksby and Jacobs here on TalkSport. Coming up in the second hour of the show, we kick off the H&J Book Club this afternoon. As we were saying earlier on, we often get asked about authors we've had in the studio and books we like and say, you know, you guys read a lot of sports books for the show. Anything you want to recommend? And we thought, OK, well, let's open this out a little bit. We do have an awful lot of guests on the show and talk about great books. So let's revisit some, as well as looking at new releases and sort of different genres, because sport is full of great writing, probably more... now so than ever. You know, there's so many great sports books out there at the moment being written every year. So we're going to kick off with the Damn United, David Peace's book, a kind of faction, wasn't it? Which caused a few issues, which we'll chat to about with Luke Moore, who you'll know from the Football Ramble and our fine show every Friday here on TalkSport with Laura Woods and Danny Kelly, the season ticket. Luke's going to be guiding us through this, and we'll chat about the book. We'd love your thoughts on that as well. TalkSport.com, text 81089. You can tweet TSHNJ and get in touch this afternoon and we'll get you involved in the conversation about that book and, of course, other books as we do it each week.
And now Colleen Rooney has decided not to call off a holiday following a row with Wayne because it's got to be at least 3 weeks since the last one.
Oh, come on, Andy. That's a cheap shot. It's a cheap shot.
It's a good shot. Honestly, though, she does love a holiday. I think it was about 11 times last year, but there you go.
All right. Well, why not? It's not affecting your life, is it? Having as many holidays as she likes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And whoever signed off the design for Brighton and Hove Albion's rain poncho needs to have a word with themselves, honestly. Don't go for a pointy white hood.
No, in any circumstances, I think somebody...
Never a great look.
Our own Max Rushton was making the point. Maybe do it in blue. Do it in blue and no one's going to draw any...
It's the thing, isn't it, that no one noticed it. You know, I mean? It is odd, though. Right?
It may be just being the nature of the way that one's being worn. I don't know. It shouldn't be as pointy as that.
A lot of people have pointed out that Roman Abramovich is not around much now for obvious reasons. He can't come into the country, or doesn't want to come into the country. And it does seem to be affecting the team. But I was thinking, you know, it's a pity because he was a really good hands-on owner. He was, you know, much better when he was hands-on. And I think he should basically go and do his pro licence and come back as a kind of Israeli coach.
Yeah, well,
dugout.
Avram Grant. Like,
yeah, well, sort of Avram Grant could be his, you know, his assistant.
Yeah. They've been making the point. I mean, a lot of pieces in today's papers about where this leaves Sarri. And, of course... You do wonder whether the Chelsea hierarchy will look at what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has done. A very different, maybe, approach to... There's been a few... I didn't realise they were training at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Chelsea. Have you seen that story?
This has been one of the bones of contention.
Yeah.
He's got this mad idea that they should train on the day of the game. It's just everything about him, everything that he's done.
So the sort of time they to do it at kickoff time. So that's why they're training in the afternoons.
But just all of it. It's all nonsense. It's all sort of like, I'm the only person that understands football. I've invented this way of playing. Well, you haven't. It's called pass and move, mate. A lot of people do it. You know, I don't see any difference between the way Wolves try and play, by the way.
No.
A lot of teams try and play. I just think it's a load of old rubbish, you know, that you can't switch between systems. You can't do... I personally... If it was me, I'd get rid of him today. I just
really,
I don't see it at all. I can't see any way of him turning this round.
We seem to be. It always seems to be that kind of that sort of anatomy of a manager leaving a job. Suddenly, the club starts to leak like a sieve. Over the next couple of days, we'll start finding stuff out we didn't know before.
I mean, one thing about Conte, which singled him out, which is the reason why he's won stuff and why Sarri never has, is Conte went into Chelsea. He saw what he had. He tried to sort of play the way the players wanted to play, but then he realised the players he had and he devised a system which suited it, partly his system, partly suited Chelsea. And it worked. And, you know, if the club had decided to back him rather than, you know, force him into what they forced him into, it would have been a lot better.
But, well, we'll see what happens.
It's very interesting last night, Moutinho taking a corner and none of the ball was touching the line on this corner. I was going, that is ridiculous. And then late, so either they noticed, Graham Scott and his officials, or someone said to them at half-time, you better watch what he's doing because he's not even putting it anywhere, even touching the line.
Wow.
So every time he took a corner, either Graham Scott came over to him or the linesman pointed. Because it does give you an advantage there. You know, if you're playing outside of the quadrant at a certain angle, it's completely different as it would be if it was a normal corner. So well done to him. I thought actually Graham Scott hasn't always been his biggest fan. I thought he had a good game last night. Good decision on the penalty claim. I thought that Atsu got the ball. And also the same with Longstaff. Well, he could have been done for foot up. It was a brilliant clearance, though, because Doherty would have scored.
It did look, in real time, that did look like a pen, didn't it? I mean, when you kind of see what the referee has to see. So you look at that, you watch the player collapse under attack and you think, oh dear, that doesn't look good.
Absolutely.
But then you see how much he got of the ball.
Brilliant. Was that?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was
brilliant.
A good tackle.
A lovely waste of ink to the sun. Well, there's a couple today, actually. Billy Goodband wrote in. He said, I'm convinced...
Billy Goodband.
That's his name.
That's a great name.
Well, this is quite appropriate, actually.
Yeah.
I'm convinced that any chance the UK has of winning the Eurovision Song Contest is ruined by making our song public weeks before the day of the contest. So its impact is lost. Yeah, that's the reason we don't win. There's nothing to do with the fact that they can't stand us and they all vote for each other.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, that's the reason.
Somebody wrote to the Telegraph, Andy, yesterday, and I wasn't aware of this rule. It's an unwritten rule, apparently. But this is to a broadsheet newspaper, so bear that in mind. Apparently, Ian Duncan Smith was spotted wearing a trilby. He said, Mr. Duncan Smith may have flouted the unwritten rules by wearing a trilby hat before the Goodwood meeting in July. Did you know that was an unwritten rule?
No, I didn't.
Have you ever
sported
a trilby in June and thought, I've gone early, I've gone pre-Goodwood?
A slightly better posh waste of ink, though, was James Carrar, who wrote from Edinburgh, and this was good, actually.
James Carrar?
Well, he was talking about some correspondence that
had gone. Has he got a parrot?
Yes.
How are you spelling Carrar?
C-R-E-R-A-C-R.
Yeah, old MacDonald had a farm.
C-R-E-R-A-R. How would you pronounce that? C-R-E-R-A-R.
Let me write that down. C-R. C-R.
Yeah.
C-R.
C-R.
Blimey, it's literally like
C-R, no.
C-R-A-R.
E-R.
E-R. C-R-E-R.
A-R.
A-R.
We need, what's his name? Gareth Chilcott. How are you?
It sounds like a kind of West Country version, Gloucester's version of Pygmalion.
If Pat Crerand
C-R-A-R-E-R-O-R.
If Pat Crerand is Paddy Crerand, is Paddy Crerand, this place has got to be James Crerar.
James Crerar? That's not a word. James Crerar. They've got some.
We've got far too locked into his name. Let me read his letter.
Oh, go on then.
He got the point of the will to live.
His name's not C-R.
Well, it's not his first name. He's James.
Okay,
he's
yeah.
He's not C-R-E-R.
C-R-E-R-A-R-O-R. Yeah.
I can't even be bothered to read this now, but it is good.
Was he in R-Har?
He said, in response to the letters about the spectators at Twickenham and Murrayfield traipsing in and out of their seats to and from the bars and lavatories, I've decided that I'm too old and unsteady on my feet to attend Murrayfield any longer. However, I much enjoy watching the matches on TV, and in order to make the experience more authentic, I persuaded my young grandchildren to walk across the room between me and the screen, carrying bottles of beer throughout the game.
Nice.
So he wants to create that feeling that you get at a sport. It is quite annoying that when people keep going for a drink. And
yeah, I preferred his name. ideally with more vowels, at least one anyway.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
Paul Hawksby, Andy Jacobs here on Talk Sports, and this is the first edition of the H&J Book Club. Every week we'll be looking at a different classic book and some new ones as they come along as well, and getting your thoughts on them, and taking your recommendations as well for books we may discuss and ones you've enjoyed and ones you've not been sure about. We're kicking off with The Damn United. It did divide opinion at the time, but it was a bit of a sort of genre breaker in football terms, wasn't it? Because it's kind of based in fact, but it's sort of faction, isn't it? It's clearly a story seen through the eyes of the author. It's not true, is it?
The lines have been blurred in this. I mean, obviously written and published in 2006 by David Peace and Faber, and it charts the ill-fated 44 days that Brian Clough spent at Leeds United following Don Revie, after Don Revie had all that success and then went on to be England manager. And it's written in a stream of consciousness style from the fictional Brian Clough's point of view, as he tries to impose his will on this group of Leeds United players, you know, previously managed by this successful manager. And he famously lasted only 44 days. It was in 1974. And along the way, he sort of alienated these key players like Johnny Giles and Norman Hunter and Billy Bremner. Now, each day he's there is a chapter in the book. It's a really interesting study of a hugely famous character. It sort of weaves sort of observation and fact with assumed character traits and fiction. So, I mean, clearly David Peace has spent a lot of time studying the man and picking up his mannerisms and his way of speaking and all that kind of stuff. But also, he has to weave with it, as you said, Paul, this fictional side to him, which I do think makes it justifiably controversial, is the way I would say, because, you know, if you're writing a novel, and this is a novel, and you're writing it and you're building a world and you're building characters and then you're building a narrative, if you then base these characters on people that actually exist, and in the case of some of them, Johnny Giles, who maybe we'll come on to in a moment, who had a problem with the book and took legal action, it is problematic. You are essentially dining out on those characters that people already know to get your story across, I suppose. And the book is a really dark book as well. I mean, if you've seen,
which is very different from the film, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the film, where Brian Clough is played by Michael Sheen, is a more light-hearted. It's very funny in places. It zips along, and it's almost a nostalgia type piece to football in the 70s, centered around this character. But the book is much darker. It portrays Clough to be a man who's driven by always striving to go one better, to achieve in the hardest circumstances possible, to make it almost difficult for himself. And the more you go through the book, the darker it gets. So he starts referring to Giles as the Irishman and Bremner as the Scotsman, and it's swearing left, right and centre. And obviously the job, the further he goes down the line, the harder the job becomes, the further more he gets entrenched. And anyway, it's a really interesting way of going about things, and it's also punctuated with these flashbacks to when Clough, supposedly these incidents in Clough's life that drive him. So him in that terrible game for Sunderland, I think against Bury, where he ruptures both his knee ligaments and ends his career in the early 60s among driving rain and frozen pitches and all sorts. And it flashes back to that, flashes back to his debates with Sam Longson, who he calls Uncle Sam, who was the chairman at Derby when he had all the success before. So there's lots going on. The narrative does flit around all over the place.
We're going to talk a bit about the style of the book in a moment, which is not everybody's cup of tea. If they've read David Peace's book on Bill Shankly as well, they'll know the style of it.
Yeah.
Is quite difficult to get into. There's an awful lot of kind of repetition. I was just trying to think, there's some sort of passages that give you a feel for the nature of the way he writes. I mean, there's one little bit he says, great detail about nothing in particular.
Yeah.
I tilt the chair back on two legs and I close my eyes. I close my eyes and I tilt the chair back. You get the idea. You've closed your eyes and you think...
I wonder why he did it like that.
I think that's very much his kind of style. Yeah. If you read his other stuff, that's the way he tends to write.
Don't you feel that sometimes that's how the human mind works as well? So you find yourself repeating stuff over in your mind and you're establishing things. I mean, there's a bit that I pulled out here, which I'll obviously won't read the swear words as part of it, but if you can imagine, it's littered with swear words as well. Irreplaceable. Derby County have finished ninth, scoring 56 and conceding 54. Irreplaceable. The symmetry being so, no consolation whatsoever, because there is no consolation. No consolation for not winning. That's irreplaceable. It's giving you an idea that the man is driven, just singularly driven by this idea that he wants to be successful.
Yeah.
And almost a sort of, do you know what, when I reread this last week, do you know what it put me in mind of? And I hate saying this, because we never go more than 5 minutes without saying this man's name on this radio station whenever I'm on it. It reminds me of a prototype Jose Mourinho.
Really?
That's what it reminds me of.
It's interesting.
I always said that.
Yeah.
I saw such similarities between the two men. I mean, it was incredible, really.
Let's just play a little bit. This is a bit from the very start of the book. It's actor Owen Teal. I think it was a reading of the book, the David Peace's book. And this kind of gives you a little bit of an insight into it.
There it is, from the motorway, through the windscreen. Hateful, hateful place. Spiteful, spiteful place. Elland Road, Leeds, Leeds, Leeds. I've seen it before, been here before. Played and managed here 6 or 7 times in 6 or 7 years. Always a visitor. Always away. Hateful, spiteful place, flecked in their phlegm.
It's a kind of a bit Shakespearean, listening to it like that. And you did, there was a play of it. And you sort of felt it was, it would have worked as a play because it's this kind of, this man's inner dialogue. You could see it being staged and it working just like that.
It's an exceptional piece, that, because Owen Teal, who plays Jorah Mormont in Game of Thrones, is a very similar in voice and timbre to how Clough actually spoke. And so, you know, the way this Brian Clough comes across in this, and you know, you see the quotes on the cover of from the Times saying the best novel ever written about sport and the novel that brought the legend back to life. But the key word here is novel. It is a novel. It's supposed to be. It's supposed to be fictional. Yeah, he's based it on this guy. And you know, maybe if we talk a little bit about how certain people portrayed in the book were unhappier about how they were portrayed, and I suppose with. Given the book was written and published after Brian Clough passed away, the libel issue isn't necessarily a problem because Clough's no longer with us, sadly. Yeah. But people like Johnny Giles, who asked very much to their live, one of the sort of elder statements of Irish football and pundits and commentators and all that kind of stuff, he was very unhappy with it. He was very unhappy by the way everyone was portrayed within it, to the point of where he claimed he had been libeled. And anyway, there was a case that was settled in which the publishers amended some of the passages within the book in the republishing of the book in 2008 without admitting any liability. So Peace has very deliberately skirted this line here. I mean, he's done it on purpose. He's blurred the lines on purpose to give such gravitas to what is a very interesting story. Yeah.
But it's based on fact. I mean, the fact is he went there. Yeah. He was only there for 44 days. Yeah. It was a particular club where the players did rule the roost. We know that.
Some of the listeners have read it. Matt Porter's been in touch. He said, it's a great book. It really puts you back to what it would have been like in that time. The two stories being played out side by side, showing the contrasting fortunes of professional sport. Cluffy was great, a great personality, so the book pretty much wrote itself. This comes from Gab Cancello. The Damn United is as close to reality to football as the Da Vinci Code is to religion. Having said that, unlike the Dan Brown novel, it's not predictable and always holds the interest, with Clough coming over as both confident and insecure simultaneously. I think
the thing about
Brian Clough was a really eloquent guy. You know, when you read the book, the nature of it, that inner dialogue, you think, well, you know, this was a man who could talk for 10 minutes without repeating himself. Yet the whole nature of him in this book is
repetitive.
So it's very stylized, isn't it?
But one of you guys mentioned earlier the idea of it being like almost like a Shakespearean type tragedy. Because and it does a very good job with that, because we do know, of course, as you mentioned, Andy, the we know the story. We know how it starts. We know how it ends. Everyone knows that. It's one of the biggest parts of football folklore in this country. But the way it's built up, he doesn't talk about... So each chapter is a day, as I mentioned earlier, but the way it's built up throughout the sections of the book is every game, because of course he only managed for, I think, 7 league games, every game isn't called a game, it's called a reckoning. And at the end of each section, it says the fourth reckoning, and it's got a poem on the other side, because obviously most of the time, if not all the time, the results are terrible, and it's just getting worse and worse for him. So there is definitely a very tragic... Shakespearean tragic type feel to it throughout the book, allied with this darkness of his mindset, which becomes darker and darker as we go along, of course.
Yeah. I mean, you look on as history tells you that it didn't affect his career particularly badly.
No.
When he went on to achieve.
Well, before or after. I mean, before or afterwards, he was very successful.
And
the greatest England manager we never had and all that kind of stuff.
We ought to mention Duncan Hamilton's book, because the family and Duncan hated this book.
Yeah.
And Duncan wrote his own book, Provided You Don't
Duncan
Kiss Me.
Duncan worked, didn't he, with Brian for years.
Nottingham Newspaper.
That's right.
And it's also an excellent book. So if you want a different view, more factual view.
Absolutely. I think if you want a factual report and biographical account of Brian Clough the man, it's Duncan.
But that's warts. I mean, to be fair, Duncan, that's kind of warts towards this. There's a warmth to it, and it's written with love. But it is, you know, it shows all sides.
Shows all sides
of him.
Another really exhaustive book about Clough is Jonathan Wilson's Nobody Ever Says Thank You, which is a doorstop thick. It's absolutely exhaustive, brilliantly researched, and that really gets to the cuts to the core of what the man was like in reality as well. This book isn't that, but I don't think it means it's any less worth reading. You know, I mean, it's a fantastic novel, and that's essentially what it's designed to be.
Larry says, read it when it was released. It still makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. You can throw all your medals in the bin.
Yeah.
Bit is pure Clough.
Iconic,
Those things, imagine you kind of, you know, you do feel that was probably close to the truth.
And so, the interview that you mentioned as well. Sorry, Paul. Yeah. That he did on the day, that would never happen now.
Yeah, this is the day he went in with Austin Mitchell, didn't he?
On calendar.
And calendar, with Don Revy and Cluffy sat down, and they sort of, after he'd gone, the day he'd gone, they sat down, three of them. And
it's a fascinating television show, that.
I mean, you couldn't have seen Jose, possibly for different reasons, legal reasons, going straight into a studio that day and talking about it.
There's a fantastic bit at the start where Austin Mitchell introduces it, and... they start talking, Clough and Revy, and after that, about 3 or 4 minutes, Don Revy makes a point, and Austin Mitchell tries to cut in, and Don Revy just cuts him down and says, I'm not finished. And, and from that moment on, he's absolutely pointless in being there, because they just go back and forth to each other the whole time, because they're such rivals. Not only were they rivals, and you guys would know this better than me, they had such different styles as well, different styles of football, different styles of approaching the game, different ways of carrying themselves, different approaches to discipline, all that kind of stuff. They really were polar opposites. And for Brian Clough to go into try to fill Don Revy's shoes, looking back on it now, it just looks like a preposterous decision from start to finish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it happened, and that interview, which we should probably share from on the Twitter or something like that, it's available to watch on YouTube, is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, we will put that out there through TSH&J. So I think in summary, the style takes a bit of getting used to, but it is worth it. So stick with it if you think, oh, I'm not sure, because it does pay out. It's The Damn United by David Peace.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
Hawksby and Jacobs here on TalkSport. Phil Hewitt is with us in the studio. He's the author of a fine book called Keep On Running that I'm sure many of you have read. Outrunning the Demons, Lives Transformed Through Running is his latest book. And Phil, good afternoon.
Hi, really nice to see you. Thank you.
Your book starts just outside Newlands after you've gone to watch a cricket match in Cape Town, and it did send a bit of a shiver down my spine. Myself and my wife trying to see a rained-off T20 game at Newlands a couple of years ago. And we were outside the ground and we couldn't find a taxi anywhere. It's not easy to find a taxi.
I recognise that, yeah.
Popped into a filling station and said, can we get a cab here? And the guy said, no, I think everybody's gone there. It's pouring with rain. The cricket was off, so you won't find anybody around here.
You didn't try walking back?
No, I didn't. No, cut a long story short, we did, in the end, manage to get back into Cape Town, because it's about half an hour outside of town. Now,
further than that.
I put that out there because you were in this situation and did decide to walk back into.
Yeah, well, it was
Cape
my first time watching England cricket abroad, and I think I was just on such a high that I just kind of left my brains in the ground, and I was just so elated. Fantastic day, England had lost, but it didn't matter. I was there, and it's such a beautiful ground. I just thought, didn't see any taxis, didn't see any buses, so I thought I'd prolong the pleasure and walk, which was desperately naive, and anyone from that area would know that's a stupid thing to
because
do.
Because Cape Town itself is, not that bad, is it? I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, you can get mugged. You can get into trouble anywhere. Yeah.
But
sure.
The walk back, certainly the walk back in on the main route back into Cape Town from Newlands, you do go past some fairly sketchy areas. And that's
the worst thing was after about 3 miles, the only way in was to walk beside a motorway. And that was pretty scary, sort of wobbling along on the hard shoulder. And then the hard shoulder stopped and I scrambled up onto a bank and looked across the motorway and could see a little path on the far side. So legged it across 8 lanes of motorway and scrambled down in the bank on the far side and ended up in a place called District 6, which I kind of recognised because it's just desolate, open, rubble, wasteland, nothing there. But I could see Cape Town in the distance on the horizon. I was walking towards it thinking, well, at least I know where I am, and heard a pitter-patter of footsteps behind me. This bloke ran up and seemed to punch me a couple of times, and I went over with the force of that. I pulled him over and he started kicking me in the stomach and just kicking. And I let go of my camera and I looked down and saw that he hadn't punched me at all. He'd actually stabbed me.
My leg
was just covered in blood. And because I pulled him over, I think I'd really annoyed him because he got to his feet with my camera and then just stood there and kicked some more.
And thankfully someone came to your aid. You talk about that in the book, but you kind of suffered effectively, as I see a lot of people do after something as traumatic as that. A form of PTSD, didn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the odd thing is it really hit me once I got home. You sort of staggered through the rest of the week, literally staggered through the rest of the week with a couple of stab wounds in my leg and 3 broken ribs. And then I think, once that starts to heal, you realise the real damage isn't the physical, it's the mental. And just so many things I wanted to know about what happened, who this guy was, why he did it, what his background was, what he did with my camera. On there was about 300 pictures of the cricket. Yeah.
Did you ever find any of the answers to any of those
Absolutely
things?
Absolutely not. No. That's the whole point. I was wondering when I was lying in all the blood on the pavement, thinking, I could feel my eyesight fading, starting to wobble, and I just felt overwhelming tiredness and just wanted to shut my eyes. Would I have died at that point? Possibly, yes. Wow. And those things just go round and round your brain and just built up into just a big panic attack.
And the book itself really tells, running was a great kind of tool, wasn't it, for you, as you kind of mentally fought your way back from what had happened to you?
It all exploded into this panic attack, and I just knew I had to do something. And I started after that, as a reaction to that, to just write down all the thoughts, all the feelings, all the worries, all the humiliations and all the terrors. But also, as part of that healing, I just went for a run. And it's 3 weeks after, and so, you know, two great big holes in my leg and three broken ribs and
you were a runner, though, already.
I'd done 30 marathons. I'd always run, always run. And just needed to get back to it. Yeah. And just getting out there. It was a lovely spring morning. Well, 3 years ago this week, the actual attacks and Valentine's Day of all days.
Wow.
And yeah, 3 weeks later, just forced myself to go for this run because I just needed to lift all the rubbish that was going around my head. And just getting out there and running did that. Just something sort of cut through all the nonsense. And, you know, it's not the cure-all, but it was just the start of moving on.
I think you found it to be a universal thing because you've spoken. The book really is a kind of collection of stories and conversations you've had with people who went through their own trauma and have used running as a way back.
Definitely. It's stories of healing. And I think, you know, the book in a nutshell is it's people who've been to hell but have discovered that the quickest, surest, safest way back is to run. So it's a collection.
I was going to say, is it the endorphins? Is that what does it? Or is it the discipline of running?
I think, you can research the scientific side, but I'm not sure that gives you all the answers. I think it's much more an emotional thing. I think when you've suffered severe trauma, you do feel really isolated and you feel incredibly stuck in that moment. Even now, you know, almost more real are the thoughts of being stuck on that pavement, all the blood thinking, am I going to die? It's almost more real than talking to you. But running just connects you, I think, and it gives you a bit of space and time, it gives you freedom. And trauma is all about loss of control, but running is so lovely because you decide where you're going, you decide what colour running top you're going to put on, you decide you turn left, turn right, etc. You decide when to stop, you decide how fast, you just regain that control through running. And I think that's why running has healed all these people. You know, lovely people I've spoken to have been caught up in 9/11 and the Boston Marathon bombing. In horrible sexual assault, one poor girl suffered, and abusive relationships, and severe illness, and depression, and addiction. But for all these people, just running has sort of put them back together to an extent. So it's not the cure for everything, but it's the step towards empowerment. It's taking back control.
And how did you find these people, Phil? Did you ask for their stories?
I'm afraid it's as crass as just sitting Googling explosion marathon, rape marathon, trauma marathon, runner and things like that.
Wow,
and just
really?
Compiled a list of good stories that have been somewhere reported and then approached the people. And I think the thing that moved me most is just how approachable the people were and how open they were to telling their stories. And I think the lovely thing in my mind about the book, it's 34 interviews sandwiched by my own experience. So it's like 35 runners. And in my mind, it's like we're all on running this same race, but all different stages of our trauma. And, you know, sometimes I might have a bad day and I'll fall back a bit slow and the others move on. But we're just all going in that same direction. Towards healing, really, and I don't know what's the end of the race, but I'm certainly glad I'm running it. And
the thing about the Boston, I mean, you think about the Boston Marathon, being injured in and caught up in something like a Boston Marathon, that must really mess with your head, because obviously to go out and run again, you've got two hurdles to overcome: the pure trauma and the fact it happened while you were running.
Yeah, well, there are two Boston Marathon running stories in there. One was a lovely woman who was just in a cafe and was blown up, and just became so important to her. I mean, to an extent, she wasn't even running it the following year. She was almost crawling it in tears, just pulling herself along in a phenomenally long time. But it was just so important for her as part of her healing that she should run that course. And the other Boston Marathon running story is as a woman who completed it on a massive high, high-fiving everyone over. She went over the line, tears of joy. And then 10 minutes later, the explosion and people running around shouting, "We need blood donations." And she became fixated on the thought that as she had high-fived people on the way towards the finishing line, she possibly high-fived the lovely little boy who was killed. And that thought just tormented her. And the only way she could get over that was to go back the following year and run it.
Amazing.
Just to lay that ghost. And what a powerful image.
It's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a sense of achievement, each run completed as well, I think. So, you know, there's a sort of satisfaction in doing any exercise that once you've done it, because there's always that thought of, oh, I don't fancy this today, it's freezing, it's this, that, and the other. But when you've done it, there is
I think the true runners know that they'll feel worse for not going.
Yes,
you might not fancy the run, but you'll kick
yourself.
You don't. You just get it done.
Well, Phil, we wish you well with the book. It's a fascinating subject, and hopefully it will inspire others if they've found themselves in a similar situation to get out and run. But reading these people's stories and your story, which was fascinating. doing it as well is very interesting. So good to see you. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much indeed. Really lovely to speak to you.
Running the Demons, Lives Transformed Through Running by Phil Hewitt.
You've been listening to the Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast. Hear the guys every weekday between 1 and 4 p.m. on TalkSport.
There we are. That was this afternoon's show. Thanks for downloading us, as always. And maybe we should try and get Peter Currer on. Maybe.
James Currer.
Peter's his brother. Yeah. Currer. Still no. Steen was another vowel, definitely. Okay. We will catch up with you tomorrow. Thanks once again for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.